All right, there's no clock in here, I think, so I better have my phone out. Hopefully it won't go off while I'm up here. Well, being back in Henderson brings back a lot of good memories from our time at school here as students and the 5 years that we were here working with this church. And I hate that Haven could not be here tonight, because this is, of course, where both of our kids were born, and you loved Haven and Pierce. But Haven remembers more of it than Pierce did. He was too little. But you loved them well, and Haven still occasionally will reflect back about our time here. For some reason, I know many of you remember the blue house that used to be across the parking lot. We lived there temporarily. To this day, that is Haven's favorite house we ever lived in. Don't ask me why. I could not tell you, but that is the favorite house she's ever lived in. And so she'll think back about that and a few other things. But you loved her well, you loved us well, and it's good to be back tonight. So I think we all love a good transformation story. Back, I think, when I was preaching here, that's when Extreme Makeover Home Edition was on, maybe on Sunday nights, and we'd get out of church here and go back home and watch somebody take this house that was just a dump, and they would, in a very short amount of time, pour all kinds of energy and money into it, and then it was just a beautiful house. And just to see that transformation, I mean, it was really inspiring to see that. I don't even know if it's still on anymore, but the Biggest Loser TV show, just to watch the transformation that these people make when they apply themselves to diet and exercise, like Pierce told me I need to do tonight. I'm working on being on that show, I guess, myself. But to see the transformation is inspiring. Or to see people, they take somebody off the street and give them a new haircut, new hairstyle, put new makeup, new wardrobe, and the before and after pictures are hardly even recognizable as the same person. Those are inspiring. They captivate something in our humanity. Something is drawn to that. But especially when we're talking about somebody's life that's transformed. Now that's thrilling to us to see that. And the best transformation stories, the ones that we're most drawn to, are the ones that are dramatic, immediate, and permanent. Like if you find a transformation story where the first time you find someone, their life is just a complete wreck. And, you know, it could be somebody who is a militant atheist. It could be someone who's just hooked on drugs or alcohol, or their life is just a complete mess. They're wasting their life. It could be someone who's of another religion, antagonistic to Christianity. And when that person encounters the gospel, they encounter Jesus, and their life is instantly transformed by that. And then they never look back, and the rest of their life is just pressing on. Then that's a story that we're drawn to that. We want to hear that. That's the classic broken but mended story that we're drawn to. And if you think back in Scripture, I guess Saul of Tarsus might be, you know, one of the most classic stories that fit that pattern. You've got the one enemy of the church that's the most notorious enemy of the church, the one person on earth that's most passionate to work against God's cause in the world. As he's going out to carry out his persecuting of the church, he encounters Jesus. His life's immediately transformed. He's permanently transformed. And he ends up becoming probably the greatest missionary Christianity has ever seen. I mean, that's a classic broken but mended story. The prodigal son. He goes out, spends time in the far distant country. The father's waiting. He's watching. He's praying. And then eventually he comes back home. Those are broken but mended stories that we love. And there's something inside of us that's drawn to that. If there's anything that we like more than those broken but mended stories, it might be if we find, I guess we could call it an unbroken story. If we find someone who just never left home to begin with. Just if we see someone who maybe they were born into a family that was the pillar of the community, they were pillars in the church, and they grew up, they were always a good kid, they were a leader in the youth group, they went off to a Christian school, and they married another leader from another youth group, they had kids, and those kids were all leaders in the youth group, and then they grew up, and they married Christians, and their kids were faithful, and before long, you've got this grandfather, or great-grandfather, or great-grandmother, great-grandmother, the matriarch, patriarch of their family, that's just this legacy of faithfulness. Now, we're really drawn to that, maybe even, that might be the only thing that we love more than a broken but mended story, is just this unbroken person. The world just never seemed to really get to them. And they and their families always lived this life of faithfulness. And that's what Noah's story sort of is. Like the first time we meet Noah, he's not an atheist. He's not a polytheist. He's not antagonistic to Christianity. First time we see him, he's not strung out on drugs. He's not in a ditch, wasted, drunk. It's not like your classic broken but mended story. In fact, here's what the scripture says. This is the first time we ever meet Noah. This is in Genesis chapter 6. It's talking about how wicked the world is. And then it says, but, this is in verse 8, but Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. And this is the account of Noah and his family. Noah was a righteous man, blameless among the people of his time, and he walked faithfully with God. And so God selects Noah. It's sort of like this new Adam, like a second Adam. He's going to redo this whole humanity thing, and he selected Noah and his family to be the new Adam that's going to repopulate the earth. He's going to start over with this man because of how righteous he is. And he tells him to do something just incredibly audacious, and for the next 100 years or so to build this humongous boat to get ready for this 100-year flood that's supposedly coming, like 10 decades from now. How does Noah respond to that? Well, it says, again, chapter 6, verse 22, Noah did everything just as God commanded him. I mean, here's a guy, it's just like the world can't get to him. I mean, the world was as wicked as it's ever been. Like every thought of all mankind was on evil continually. And here's Noah in the midst of all that. It's just unbroken by all that. And the world can't get to him. He's a blameless, righteous, faithful man. And he saves his kids, his family as a result of that. God tells him to do this crazy thing and he does it to the letter. Everything that God commanded, that's what he's doing. And the text even tells us that again in chapter 7, in verse 5. Noah did all that the Lord commanded him. So here's Noah that's on his way to living this unbroken story that we love to tell. And then, right before he crosses the finish line, he trips up and falls on his face. I mean, he builds the boat, he's saved from the flood, and he gets out of the boat, and in time he plants this vineyard. Chapter 9 of Genesis tells us this part of his story. Genesis 9, starting in verse 20. Noah, a man of the soil. There's probably a lot of meaning in that. It's not just that he had land, but he's a man of the earth. Like Adam was made from dust. He's like all of us. He's a man of the dust. He's a man of the earth. He's a man of the soil. As God has compassion on his children, as a father has compassion on his children, so the Lord has compassion on us. He knows how we were formed. He remembers that we're dust. Here's Noah, this man of dust. The world just doesn't seem like it can get to him, but he's a man of dust still. He's a man of the earth still. And it says that he proceeded to plant a vineyard. When he drank some of its wine, he became drunk and lay uncovered inside his tent. Ham, the father of Canaan, saw his father naked and told his two brothers outside. But Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it across their shoulders. Then they walked in backward and covered their father's naked body. Their faces were turned the other way so that they would not see their father naked. When Noah awoke from his wine and found out what his younger son had done to him, he said, "Cursed be Canaan, the lowest of slaves, will he be to his brothers." He also said, "Praise be to the Lord, the God of Shem. May Canaan be the slave of Shem. May God extend Japheth's territory. May Japheth live in the tents of Shem, and may Canaan be the slaves of Japheth." After the flood, Noah lived 350 years. Noah lived a total of 950 years, and then he died. So here's Noah's almost unbroken story. He started out so good. He lived for 600 and something years so well. And then this happened. There's nothing glamorous about this. It's as scandalous as it seems as we read it. He gets wasted and he passes out naked in his tent. That's what happened. And it's not something that just happened in private. This is, the kids knew about it. The whole family knows about it. It was known. Like this shame of Noah was known. There's no hiding it. Now here's, I guess, I've got a few questions. The first one is, what do we do with that? What do we do with Noah's story? It's not a broken but mended story. It's not the kind we like to tell. And it's not an unbroken story either. It's like maybe an almost unbroken story. But really, Noah's story really turns our theme on its head. It turns everything upside down, and it's really a mended but still broken story. That's Noah's story. He was mended. He was saved. He was rescued from the flood because of his righteousness and faithfulness, and he was blameless. He was mended. He was saved from the flood. He did everything that God commanded. He was mended. He was saved. He's a good, faithful man for 600 and something years, but yet he's still broken. I mean, that's not a story we're drawn to. It's not like the younger boy when he was a young man. He goes out and sows some wild oats in the far distant country and then comes back and then lives the rest of his life faithful, and it's just this great. It's not that kind of story. And it's almost like the father in that story who raises his kids and everything's going great, and then on his 70th birthday, he runs out for this wild weekend in the far distant country. What do you do with that? That's kind of the first question. What do you do with that? Second question that comes to my mind is, what does God do with that? What did God do with Noah's mended but still broken story? What did he do? I mean, that's the crucial question there. What did God do with Noah's mended but still broken story? Which leads, my mind takes me to the next question. It seems like the logical place to go. What if the church did what God did with mended but still broken stories? What did God do with Noah's story? What did God do with it? There's a couple things that really stand out to me. Here's the first thing that I feel like God did. God was honest about this part of Noah's life. And it's hard for me to communicate just how inspiring that is to me, this is one of the things I love most about Scripture. This is one of the things I love most about God's approach to Scripture. If it were me writing Scripture, I would be so tempted to gloss over or edit out so many of the imperfections of the heroes in this book that God does, he doesn't edit it out. It would have been so easy for me. This is just one little slip up. Just don't even mention that about Noah. Just don't even mention that. Just let people continue to think that he was as good as perfect always as they always thought he was. Don't go there. But over and over and over again, God goes there. And here's the fascinating thing about it. By God recording this about Noah, by God letting us in on this part of Noah's story, and being honest about it, here's the amazing thing. We don't love Noah less. Just like we don't love David less because we know about his stuff. and we don't love Peter less because we know about Peter's stuff. And we don't love, you name any of the people that you're talking about in the summer series. Here's the amazing thing. God tells us this stuff about them, and we don't love them less. God tells us this stuff, and we don't question the authenticity of their relationship with God. We don't question their previous faithfulness. We don't question the credibility of spirituality. We don't call any of that into question. If anything, we respect Scripture more because it's an authentic accounting of what really happened. And we are more drawn to these people because we can see in them our own humanity. And they're not caricatures that we can never live up to. They're real people with real strengths and real weaknesses, just like we're real people with real strengths and real weaknesses and struggles, and we can relate to them, and it draws us to them. God was honest about this part in Noah's mended but still broken story. What if... This is scary. What if we could be honest in our church community? What if we could be honest and kind of dare to take off the masks, dare to take off the facades, dare to lay some of that down and say, you know what? Here's the truth of my humanity, and here's the struggle that I'm going through right now. Just here it is. You know why we don't do that? I'm scared to death of that. I think we're all scared to death of that. Why? Because we fear people are not going to love us. They're going to love us less if they know that about me. We fear that. And we also fear that we're going to lose respect. People are going to respect us less and love us less. If they really knew me, they wouldn't love me. If they really knew me, the things that I struggle with, they wouldn't respect me anymore. But here's the irony in all this. The irony in all this is that by taking that route and living in our fears, we end up birthing these fears into reality by living in those fears. And what happens is we end up not being able to cultivate the relationships of love and intimacy with our brothers and sisters because we're unwilling to step out of our fear and dare to reveal our true humanity to them. And so we end up lacking that intimacy. Somebody said that intimacy is into me see. The more you see into me, the more you know me, the more you can love me, the intimacy. And by living in our fears of that, we end up birthing those fears. And so our relationships and our community lacks the depth of love as a result. That's the irony in all of this. The hope in all of this, and probably the only thing that's strong enough to get us out of our fear, is the hope of something better. The hope of healing. The only way really to be free of the power of our struggles is to bring them into the light. By bringing them into the light, we can then be free of those struggles. And it not only helps us and brings us healing, it helps others. Our honesty in turn leads others and gives others the courage to be honest and find healing themselves. This honesty is what creates those Me Too moments. When somebody comes to you and confides some struggle of theirs to you. And if you're honest, if you have the capacity to be honest about your own struggles and your own humanity when somebody comes to you with their struggles, all right? If you have the capacity to be honest about your own humanity, that creates the possibility for this Me Too moment where you don't say to them, here's what you need to do. You don't give them unsolicited advice. You don't preach them a little mini sermon, give them a lecture of how they need to get everything straightened up. You don't say, I'm going to pray for you and leave it at that. But you say, me too. I get it. I may struggle. That may be the same. The same thing you're talking about is I struggle with that same thing. Or it may not be exactly that, but it's I've got my own share of struggles, and you pick anyone you want. I get it. I get what it's like to be human. I get what it's like to struggle. Me too. There's something liberating, freeing, and healing about that. What did God do with Noah's mended but still broken story? He was honest about it. He was honest about it. It's that community that James envisions in James 5:16. Confess your trespasses to one another. Pray for each other. What's going to come out of that? Healing? That you may be healed. The prayer of a righteous person is effective. It's powerful as it is working. God was honest. Here's the second thing. And this to me is probably even... The first one's huge. I think this one's even bigger. What did God do? He was honest, but he was also gentle. He was gentle. Yes, he told us what happened. And he just left it at that. Did you notice that about the text? I read that text to you in Genesis 9. Did you hear an ounce of condemnation? An ounce of judgment? An ounce of shame? God was honest about what happened. He didn't gloss over it or pretend like it didn't happen. But when he told us about it, he did not read God saying this to Noah. Noah got drunk, he got wasted, passed out in his tent naked. And so God says, Noah, I made a big mistake choosing you, buddy. I'm just going to have to wipe you and your family off. You're not what I thought you were. And I'm just going to raise up from these stones new people, and I'll rebuild the human race with these stones turned to people. I'm just going to do that. Don't hear that. God didn't write him off. God didn't give up on him. He told us what happened. Now there is condemnation in this text. There is a curse in this text, but you know what? It's not for Noah. And honestly, this was, I mean, in getting ready for tonight, this was probably the part that was the most surprising. Yeah, Noah did what he did. The text does not explicitly, we know drunkenness and we know that's not right, but the text doesn't go into all that and condemn and shame Noah. It doesn't. It just tells us. But there is condemnation and cursing in this text, but it's not for Noah. You know who it's for? It's for Noah's son who exploited his father's shame. And there's a strong curse on Ham and a strong curse on Ham's family, his son Canaan, became the Canaanites, Noah's grandson. There's a strong curse on them for exploiting their father's shame. I wonder if that doesn't suggest something. I wonder if that doesn't suggest that to exploit another's shame is the most shameful act of all. What Noah did, shameful, sure. Did God shame him and go? No, he told us what happened. Did anybody, there's only one person that exploited his father, Noah's shame, and it was Ham, and that person had a strong curse placed on him and his family. To exploit another's shame may be the most shameful act of all. God was gentle. Noah's other two sons, Shem and Japheth, were gentle. They saw their father in his vulnerable, exposed state. And what did they do? They didn't capitalize on that. They covered him. They covered his shame. Put a blanket between them, walked in his tent backwards, covered his shame. just like God, they were gentle. They were gentle. Ham's attitude was probably something akin to, he made his bed, he's going to have to lay in it. Just this cold, calloused, he made his bed, he's going to have to lay in it. We're just going to leave him there, just like that. Maybe he'll wake up and learn his lesson. Whatever. Not Shem and Japheth. Shem and Japheth didn't say, oh, he made his bed, he's going to have to lay in it. They said, he's lying in his unmade bed. We're going to have to cover him. We're going to have to cover his shame. And they, with great gentleness, covered their father's shame. Because it may be, again, the most shameful act of all is to exploit the shame of another. And here's the big question now. What did God do with Noah's mended but still broken story? That's one thing. He was honest and he was gentle. But what about the church? Are we honest and are we gentle? Here's the hard question for us. Is will we capitalize on other shame? Or will we cover other shame? What is going to be our response to the struggles of other people? And I feel like God is calling us. God is this king. He's this father who is calling us, just like King David, father of his wayward son Absalom. Remember what David said to Joab and the generals? Deal gently. Deal gently with my wayward son. And what is God saying through Scripture? Deal gently with my wayward people. Deal gently with my wayward children. Is the church going to follow the Father's lead? Or is the church going to go out like Joab and fill his gut full of javelins? When that happened, it brought David grief. Grieved David's heart when they treated his wayward son that way. I think it grieves God's heart when we capitalize on others' shame rather than covering others' shame. That's the question for us. What are we going to do? Are we going to be a David? Are we going to be a Joab? Honesty, gentleness. That's what the Apostle Paul tells us. When someone's been overtaken in a trespass, what do we do? What do we do about that? He made his bed, he's got to lay in it. Let's see if we can exploit this person's shame for our own, you know, prop ourselves up on others' shame to make us look more righteous. Or let's just walk out of his tent callously and don't even minister to that person. Probably not worth it anyway. When someone's overtaken a trespass, you who are spiritual, go restore that person in the spirit of gentleness. Gentleness. In recognition of your own humanity. With an honest take on your own humanity. Considering yourself, lest you also be tempted. Understand that you're subject to human weakness, just like that person. It may be you next time instead of them. And so very gently, with utmost honesty about our own human struggles and human weaknesses, restore that person. That's what the text says. Honesty and gentleness. Another way to frame the question for us, let me see how I'm doing here. I was afraid of that. Another way to frame this question for us is, are we going to follow Jesus? Are we going to follow his lead? Or are we going to follow the Pharisees' lead? The Pharisees were very good at not being gentle with others' shame. They were very good at exploiting others' shame, capitalizing on it. John 8 might be the classic example. They catch this woman in this vulnerable, exposed condition, caught in adultery. They snatch her up, parade her through the streets like Hester Prynne in the Scarlet Letter, plop her down at Jesus' feet, and say, Moses says she needs to die, what do you say? They could care less about this woman. They could care less about her. They didn't think twice about exploiting her shame. picking up stones ready to put her out of her misery. And what does Jesus do? He forces them to reflect, honestly reflect, on their own human condition and their own struggles. And he says, all right, whoever's without sin, you cast the first stone. It's amazing how gentle they became at that point, isn't it? Stones just started falling. Because they got an honest look at themselves. They just walk out. And then Jesus says, where are your accusers? Where'd they go? He says, they all left. And Jesus says, neither do I condemn you. Right? The Son didn't come in the world to condemn the world, but that the world through Him might be saved. That's why God sent Jesus. Neither do I condemn you. Go, leave your life of sin. Right? I mean, yeah, we know you've got a past, but you've got a future. Go. Sin no more. Leave your life of sin. Don't continue in sin. You've got a future, and it's going to be a brighter one than your past. What Jesus did, He turned her scarlet letter into a pendant of grace. I love that about Jesus. He didn't do what the Pharisees did. He didn't exploit her shame. He covered her shame. Not with leniency, not with saying sin doesn't matter, but with forgiveness, grace, and mercy. Jesus was tough as nails on sin. The Pharisees didn't think so. But Jesus was tough as nails on sin. He proved it when He went to the cross. But He was gentle. Jesus says the Pharisees put burdens on people. They weren't willing to bear them, but they're going to put them on you. They were heavy burdens on people. And you know what they forgot? Jesus told these same people, He said, you need to go. Here are these learned men, right, these scholars. He says, you need to go and learn something. He says, you need to go learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. The prophets said that over and over and over again. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. And the prophets would say, listen, if you're not going to deal mercifully and gently with others, if you're not going to restore justice in your community, if you're not going to do any of that stuff, shut the doors. Isaiah says it, Malachi says it, it's all over. Shut the doors. Your worship is noise. Your faithful attendance is trampling of My courts. Just shut it. Shut it down. If you're not going to deal gently and merciful with others, just shut it down. Because if you continue to operate, keep the doors open, continue to operate the way you're operating, you're going to shut the kingdom in people's faces anyway. I mean, these are some of the strongest words in Scripture, reserved for the Pharisees who lacked mercy, who did not understand what Jesus meant when He said, I desire mercy, not sacrifice. And Jesus told them, Matthew 23, you shut the kingdom of heaven in people's faces. You don't go in, you don't let them in either. In stark contrast to them is Jesus, who deals gently. In fact, He says, come to Me. Are you burdened? Are you weary? Come to Me. I'll give you rest. Take My yoke upon you. Learn of Me. I'm gentle. Gentle. I'm humble in heart. You're going to find rest for your souls. Because My yoke is easy, My burden is light. Why is Jesus' burden light? Because He's more lax on sin than the Pharisees? No, because He's going to be there to help them bear and to cover it. Come. And guess what? They came. They came. And here's Matthew. Matthew's this tax collector turned apostle. You talk about a broken but mended story. Matthew's watching Jesus do all this. Matthew's recording all of this. And Matthew remembers a prophecy about the Messiah from Isaiah. And Matthew said, you know what? Jesus is doing all of this. This ministry of mercy. All of this is happening to fulfill what was spoken by the prophet Isaiah. And one of Isaiah's prophecies about the Messiah is this. A bruised reed He will not break. And a smoldering wick He will not snuff out. It comes from Isaiah 42. We see it again in Matthew chapter 12. I mean, this was astounding. Back in those days, a reed was, of very little value. They grew up by the millions, by riverbeds. If you take a little one, use it as a writing instrument. If it gets bruised or bent or splintered, just throw it away. Get another one. It wasn't worth much to start with. It's worth nothing now, and it's sure not worth your time to try to rehabilitate this worthless reed and make it usable again. Throw it away, get another one, discard it. They would light their homes with lamps filled with oil with a little wick or piece of material that was designed to give light to the house. Every once in a while, a wick would start smoldering and would give off more smoke than light. And when that happened, you just take the wick out and put another wick in and throw the old one away. It was a worthless piece of material. The last thing anybody would think to do was to try to somehow salvage that faulty wick. They just snuff it out and get a new one. And Matthew says, Jesus didn't do that. Jesus expended himself for these expendables. Jesus did the most for the least. That's what Jesus did. He found a bruised reed. Hey, everybody else may discard that person. Everybody else may shove them to the margins of society and the spiritual faith community. Not Jesus. He's not going to break that reed. Bruised, splintered, or broken as it is. He's going to gently invest himself in that person. A smoldering wick, he is not going to snuff out. He's not going to be like Ham and exploit that person's shame. He's going to be there like Shem and Japheth to gently restore that one. And this is how passionate Jesus was about his ministry of mercy to the bruised reeds and the smoldering wicks. This is how passionate he was. He was so passionate that he became a bruised reed. To heal bruised reeds like us. He was bruised, the servant song in Isaiah 53 says, he was bruised for our iniquities. He became that smoldering wick whose light was snuffed out to heal smoldering wicks like us. The Apostle Peter said, you killed the author of life. But he goes on to say, but death could not keep its hold on him. And the servant song in Isaiah said, when he has suffered, he will see the light of light, life, and be satisfied. His life was snuffed out. And on the third day he rose, and the light of the world still shone, so that he could offer to us life and light. He became a bruised reed. For bruised reeds like us, he became a smoldering wick whose life was snuffed out for smoldering wicks like us, and he calls the church to follow his lead and to be honest about our own struggles and to be gentle with the struggles of other people.
Please stand for a close.